All right, fellas, the closing session. I'm Tommy T. I'm an alcoholic. I have had an amazing weekend with you, man. And none of the talks really touched me. But every one-on-one talk did. I see how much we're alike, and it just blows my mind because I spent more than half my life thinking I was the only one. And then I come out to California and I see there's a lot of sick guys out there. And it just makes me feel good. Makes me feel good. They tell you compare, don't identify, don't compare. BS. Compare. See where you're at. How sick am I? I'm not a 10 in this room. I could point the 10s out to you. I'm not a 1 in this room. I'm in the middle somewhere. In the herd. Safe and protected. Because I hang out with you guys. And, you know, Jimmy, when this came about, you know, they said, oh, you got 6 topics, and we threw out a couple that we love to do, the daddy issues and stuff like that. But we didn't know what we were going to do today. I've been experiencing, I'm going to say, from 25 years of sobriety to today, a shift that I feel. You know, when we go through the 12 steps, people notice we're getting better and we don't know it. Like, we don't see it, and people are telling us, you know, you're a different guy. Something's going on with you. It's happened at a few different times in my sobriety. It's happening now, because I know when I spoke about that feeling of just not being good enough, the fears that you're not supposed to have as a big man, as a grown man, as a father, as a husband. And I go through life thinking, I'm just not good enough to do it. And when I do it, and things turn out well, I think like I faked my way through it. It's just a negative connotation in my head that just pounds me. It's kind of like when Eric's voice tells him, kill yourself. Mine just said, you're not good enough. You're never gonna be good enough. You're lying, you're doing this. Even when I'm telling the truth, it's crazy. And then you start to say to yourself, I shouldn't be having these thoughts at 60 years old, 20, 25 years sober. And then you talk to a guy that's got 50 years and he's in his 70s, he's like, why should you be any different? It makes me feel better. So I do compare with guys in AA, whether that's against the rules or not. I just want to see where I'm at. Am I in the game? And I'm here to report I'm in the game. I am not perfect at this stuff. Fellas, I try to practice this, not because I want to levitate above you guys and be that AA guy. If I don't, I'm a lunatic. Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you a couple of stories. The topic now is the joy of being a good man. And it came freely from my tongue to Jim. I said, let's do the joy of being a good man, because we want to do this next year down at a sponsorship retreat Jim and I are leading. And then I said to myself, Jesus, what am I going to talk about? But there has been times, especially in, it's been through my sobriety and through putting together a blended family and learning what it is to be a partner and a husband and love my wife and in AA, a sponsor and a sponsee, that I've had those moments, those glimpses. I felt good. It wasn't about me. I did something for somebody else, and I'm not looking for the pat on the back. Now, I'm the kind of guy that if I don't use the C word at home, I think I should get a pat on the head because I was thinking it, but I didn't say it. You don't get any points for that. Good men don't do that. But in my head somewhere, there's still not a good man. But I think it's changing in my heart. I don't think I could see, because I never finish anything, right? I'm good at things. Like, I can unleash the power of now after I read a Tony Robbins book for about 3 days. And then I'm off to the same thing and I forgot what I read. But I've been on this journey for 30 years now. And these last 5, I think there's a shift going on. I never, ever cry until these last 5 years. And all of a sudden, I'm a pussy. There's no other way to say it. I mean, my wife now was like, oh, he's crying. She thinks it's hot. That's cool. I'm okay with it now. Because all I did was, before I spoke to you guys on Friday night, was pray, just, Tom, be yourself. Don't exaggerate the stories. Don't tell the funny gross jokes. Don't do anything of that stuff that you used to do. Just be yourself. Open up. Tell them where you're at. And I've had a wonderful experience here. I just hope you guys aren't just mortified and waiting to get out. But there's been some things along the way that have been signs and glimpses of this, and I'd just like to share some of them with you. So you know the guilt and shame that I carry about having that boy up for adoption. Oh, that's still with me. I also have something with my biological son, Brett, who's 39 years old, and he's 12 years sober. And I wasn't there for the first time. I met him on his 9th birthday when I was 3 years sober. I got greeted at the door when his aunt answered and said, "Oh, nice of you to make his first birthday when he's 9. Hi, Ange. Nice to see you, too." I had a sponsor. I said the 7-step prayer. I walked into hostile territory. I brought my sister and my niece with me. That's how afraid I was. I can't do this by myself. We were supposed to have supervised visits. It was a very contested court thing and everything. It was a mess because I was on self-will. But then I went through these 12 steps. And one day in court, I stood up and they were asking for more money, joint counseling, supervised visits, everything I didn't want. I tried to play the victim role in court for 2 years and it didn't work. And I don't know what happened. Well, I know what happened. God showed up. And I stood up and my attorney tried to pull me down and I just slapped his arm away and I said, "Your Honor, I'm willing to do anything you need me to do to get to see this boy. This has gone on long enough." And I said, "I'll pay for the counseling. I'll do the supervised visits, whatever you need me to do." And he said, "Okay, we were off the record, but I want to go back on the record for a second." He said, "Mr. Taracco, that is the first time in over 2 years, two painful years," he said, "that I've seen you say anything that tells me that you're worthy of being this boy's father. You can see your son." And I had one supervised visit with my wife, my ex-wife. It was painful, fellas. It was painful. I had a sponsor. I prayed. I went. And after that visit, she said, "He doesn't need to be supervised. He's built for this. He can handle this kid." And me and Brett became best friends. That's a mistake with your son when he's that young, by the way. You should be his father, not his best friend. I made some mistakes. But today he is my best friend. And I'm a guy in AA with my sponsees and stuff. And I would have told you 4 years ago, I would have stood here and say, I've never raised my voice in my home. 3 stepchildren, crazy Irish, alcoholic wife, stepkids, grandkids living with me. I have never raised my voice. I practice these spiritual principles in all my affairs. Inside, I'm like a duck on the pond. I can stand there, take a deep breath, and I'm calm, cool, and collected, but under the water, my mind's going like this, and I want to hurt somebody. That's what's going on in my head. So I'm homesick from work. I'm still working 4 years ago, and my son hadn't answered about 4 texts. He stopped going to AA after COVID. Right? He literally screwed himself out of AA. He slept with so many of the girls in Staten Island AA. He came into a meeting and they were all talking together. He hasn't been back since. But I was worried about him. But our daughter is in a relationship with this guy and she's throwing him out of the apartment. Right? Apartment that we paid for the furniture for. We set them up in, everything. And he says he wants to talk to me. And he comes over and he's pitching his heart out why he wants to stay with Callie and this and that. And I'm just giving him a kind of AA talk. Listen, if it's going to be, it's going to be. But if you try to force the issue, you're going to push her further away. You need to move out. And I know my sons, they'll come out and they'll come down and get you out. So you can go out like a gentleman and have a chance of possibly patching up the relationship. Or you can dig in, but it ain't going to go well for you. And I'm having that, I'm mid-conversation with that. My son had got a $900 check mailed to our house because he'd never changed his address. We still get his bills. It's horrible. And I send him a text, "Brett, you have a $900 check here. Come by." Nothing. Ghosted. 2 days. I'm freaking out. I'm thinking he's dead somewhere. Because you know from what we've done to our parents, when you don't hear, you got a sober person in your house and you're hearing from them all the time and then they go silent on you, you think the worst. And I thought the worst. And I'm talking to this kid here, I'm not feeling well, and in walks Brett. We got an open door, you know, they just come walking in. And what I wanted to say was, son, I've been worried sick about you. Where you been? What I said is, where the you been? And he just kept walking, and he said, I'm a grown-ass man, Pops. I don't need to answer to you. Where's my check? This kid, Mike, is in mid-sentence, right? And I put my hand up, and I said, this needs to wait. I got to deal with this. And I shoot out of my chair, and I follow him into the kitchen. I said, who the F do you think you're talking to? And he turned around, and he got up in my face and said, I'm talking to you, Pop. I'm right here. Thank God for moments of clarity. My son's about an inch taller than me. He goes to the gym 6 days a week. He's a professionally trained Muay Thai fighter. I don't stand a chance. This ain't looking good for the home team. And the best thing this spiritual giant could get out of his mouth, I was by the drain board, and I grabbed the steak knife and said, I'll put this effing thing in your chest. I brought you into this world. I'll take you out.
Yeah.
Loud. And he said, yeah, right. Grabbed the check and stormed out. I started vibrating. What did I do? What did I do? I said, Mark, you got to go. Threw him out. I'm sitting in the living room by myself. My wife was on a phone call with Sponsee in the bedroom. So it was maybe 30 seconds, a minute, I don't know. Seemed like an eternity to me. I'm sitting there, I got my head down. I'm just like, what did I do? My wife comes out and says, who was that? And I just looked at her and I said, that's the guy you married, honey. You just never met him. I was devastated. It happened, I could tell you the day of the week it was. It was Tuesday. Because I got a Zoom call with my sponsor in an hour and a half. I'm like, oh, man. So I talked to her for a while, and I sent him a text. We agreed to have breakfast that Saturday. But I got to get on the phone with Harold. So Joe was a technician. Joe taught me the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12. Joe was a great guy with inventory. Harold's not that guy. Harold is a spiritual man that has been practicing these principles for 30 some odd years, and he's just real good at it. And I get on that Zoom call with him, and fellas, this is where the crying started. Oh, I just broke down, and he said, what's wrong, man? And I said, I just blew up with my son, and I told him the story. And he said, oh, Tommy. He said, listen, there's more going on there than what just happened in your house. You got to do some looking here, you know. And I said, well, I'm willing to do anything. And he said, it just came to him. You know, sponsorship doesn't come that easy to me. Sometimes God inspires me and I say stuff that didn't come from me, and I know that. But Harold does it routinely. He's the perfect sponsor for me. And that's a message I hope you guys hear. God has always put the right men in my life if I'm willing to hear it. And he said, are you willing to get on your knees? He knew I don't pray on my knees. And I said, I'm willing to do anything. You know, it was bad. And he said, I want you to write an inventory on the expectations you have for your son. It didn't register with me. So I go back to what I'm comfortable with. I said, do you want that in 11-step format? Or more like a 4th step? He put his hands in his head. He said, I don't care about the format. I care about the content. Pray to God. Tell me what that prayer looks like and ask God to show you the expectations you have of my son. I said, okay, I'll do that. He said, call me back when you do. I got on my knees and I was bawling and I'm leaning over the bed and I'm praying and talked to God for a while. And I got up and I put pen to paper and 7 expectations came out on that page and I didn't even know what I was looking for. But the first one stands out for me. It said, I have an expectation that my son rejoins AA and gets hooked up with a sponsor and starts doing all the things that I've done here because I don't want him to die and I'm fearful. And that's true. That's 100% true. But God didn't stop the pen there. It went on to say, I want him to do the inventory work that I've done on my father so he can forgive me for not being there for the first eight years of his life. There was a lot of stuff that came out in that inventory. I owed all the Harold. I would have never seen it just staying in the mechanics, you know? And I'm not knocking the mechanics. I'm just saying I would have never seen it. Fast forward, I got a lunch with my a breakfast with my son on Saturday. I shared it with Harold, and he was happy that I saw those things. I was a different man after the inventory talking to Harold. I was clear. I knew exactly what my problems were, my faults were. And I went to that breakfast, and I'm having one of the best talks with my son that I've ever had. It's like a shift to man, you know, he stood up to his dad. For a dad, that's a tough day. That's a tough day. But for a son, that's a big day. And I know that because I've caught a punch too, you know. I've stopped my father from hitting me, and that was a big day. And he said, Dad, I feel pretty open with you now. Can I tell you something? Because I got a little bit of a resentment. And I said, absolutely, son. Let's put it all on the table today. I read those expectations that I had for him. And he said to me, you know, I think Cheryl and the kids take advantage of you. And it hurts me when they do. He said, I see you going out of your way, paying for their college, doing everything. You're always walking around broke. And I just, you know, I don't like to say it. He said, that's not the way I was raised. He lived with me after he was 12 years old. And I said, I get it, son. Can I respond to that? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, the angle you're not seeing here, son, is I burn with guilt about not being there for you for 8 years and for putting a boy up for adoption, your brother Matthew. And if God's given me another chance to be a father, and a third chance at being a husband, I'm willing to do anything. I don't think I use the corny language to go to any lengths, but that's what I was saying to him. And I said, and I just hope that you give me that grace to try to make up for my past deeds by doing these good deeds. He just smiled at me and he said, I would have never seen that, Pop. You do what you gotta do. You're a good man. And the crying continued. You know, our youngest boy, AJ, football star from Albany, we had a great, great time. This kid was with me since he's 8 years old. When he got banged up, he wouldn't go to the hospital to get the stitches out. He'd ask me to take him out. I used to sit him on my knee and we'd read stories about whatever it is, but I used to read them in the characters' voices and he used to love it. You know, we just bonded real quick and real good. And I was having a lousy day. I was at work and everything was so busy. I get a text from him, he's up at college now. And he says, I heard this song and I thought of you. We've had a great time together, haven't we? Question mark, with a smile face, you know. And it was a country western guy. And the name of the song is My Boy. And it talks about, ain't got my blood, ain't got my name, but if he did, I'd love him just the same. He ain't my son, but he's my boy. It said something about, but then it said, but I ain't missed a ball game yet. It was a stepfather's perspective on his relationship with his son. I was bawling in my car. The crying continues. And he calls me dad. You know, it's just, he's got a father, and his father's in his life. He calls me dad. Then Callie, our middle girl, man, she struggled. Beautiful girl, killer body, beautiful face, most intelligent person in our family. Dropped out of high school because of anxiety and depression. And our mother tried everything a mother would try. Come on, Cal, all you gotta do is get to school this week. You'll do it, this and that. And I took a different approach. I took the AA approach. I said, well, Cal, I'm not co-signing being a dropout. You're so smart. I said, but I dropped out. I said, the only thing you're changing is your graduation date. You'll graduate when you can feel you can do it. I said, I have all the faith in the world in you. And all of a sudden, Callie starts talking to me. And her mom gets a little, not upset, but like, why is she talking to you? I said, honey, I don't know. I just listen. I just talked to Lucas Monty. I don't know. She's lost. She's powerless right now over what's going on. And she gets it in gear. She takes the GED. She applies for 5 colleges. She gets accepted and gets scholarships in all of them, except for the one she chooses to go to. And that was the University of Alabama. And, so she was going to take all those loans out. And now the boy that's living with us now with the grandkids, he's got $80,000 in loans he can't get out from under, you know. And I said, honey, you know, let's just pay for the college. And then I walked away and I said, did I just say that? But it came right from my heart. Like, no, let's not saddle her with all that. Let's pay. So it wasn't just the tuition. It was $1,000 a month in housing. It was everything she needed. A car to get her down there, you know, it was a big expense. So I proudly own a $250,000 Alabama t-shirt. Because she went for 3 years and didn't graduate because the problems plagued her. But when she got accepted and went to her first class, I was in Mayor Bloomberg's office getting ripped up on some stuff with new schools and closing schools, and I'm taking a beating. And I walk out, my phone rings, and it's Callie. She had never called me, and I'm in her life maybe 10 years at that point. And she called me and she said, I just went to my first class at Alabama. She said, it was awesome. I could hear the joy in her voice. She said, us GED guys, we do pretty good, right? And I said, yeah, honey, we do pretty good. Put down the phone and I'm bawling. I'm in my suit and tie in front of City Hall and I'm just crying. Robert, the middle guy who's living with us now, tough nut. His father, who I knew as a kid, didn't walk out on him per se, but he got married right away after Cheryl and him divorced. They were only together for a year. And he just started a new family and forgot Robert. And I know it kills this kid. And I know it, and I've tried everything that AA's taught me to try to reach this kid. The best I would get out of him is on New Year's Eve, he'd be out and he'd call mom to wish her a Happy New Year. And he'd say, put Tom on the phone. I just want to tell you I love you, man. You know, that's the best I could get out of him when he was hammered. But if I ever tried to have a man-to-man conversation with him, because I know we all need men in our lives, I got one word answers. So he finally just put a down payment on a house, signed the contract, and they're moving out February 1st. And we've lived with our grandkids for the last 3 years. It's been 5 years since COVID. And I'm happy they're leaving. But at the same time, there's a little sadness there too. And all of a sudden, I say, look, I'll help you with the work. And I go to Home Depot and I spend a couple hundred and I go down the house and we're sheetrocking and we're taping together. I can only do 3 to 5 hour shifts. The back goes, I'm sore as hell the next day. I'm taking a hot bath that night so I can go the next day. And I've been doing that for about 6 weeks coming up to this. This is my first weekend off in a while, by the way. And he wrote me a birthday card Wednesday. It's my 66th birthday. And it started with, you're the best father a guy could have. Pretty good. For a guy like me, who doesn't think that, you know, I have anything to do with kids. You know, I'm a deadbeat dad and all those things. Am I healed? No, I'm not fully healed. It's getting better. There is joy in doing the right thing. There is joy in giving of yourself. There's a joy in following men like you guys, listening to your sponsor and doing the things that aren't comfortable. You know, there's a great line in step 7 in the big book. It's the only thing I'm going to read this weekend to you. It said, well, obviously good character building was something one needed to get on with the business of being self-satisfied. With the proper display of honesty and morality, we'd stand a better chance of getting what we really wanted. But whenever we had to choose between character and comfort, the character building was lost in the dust of our chase for after what we thought was happiness. What's happiness? My father told me what happiness was. It's power. It's money. It's the right girl. It's all those outside bells and whistles. Happiness is fleeting. For a guy like me that suffers from a disease of war, there's never enough to keep me happy. Never enough. If I got the Camaro, I want that GTO. That 69 GTO is hot. If I got the blonde, I'd really like to sample a redhead. I got 1,000 in my pocket. I'm 16 years old. I need 1,500. 1,500's the number. Get that number, it's not good enough. Just want to feel nice? Oh, let's go to oblivion, right? It's my whole life. So I can never be happy. I don't identify so much with restless or irritable. I was a kind of a happy-go-lucky guy. But discontent, oh man, that hits my soul. I'm just never happy. I got to tell you, fellas, I'm not happy today. I'm joyful today. That question I ask, how's my spirit? I'm grateful and I'm joyful today. My joy is unshaken because my life's shifted. I've done this long enough now that it is starting to chip away. It's like the Berlin Wall and I got a ball peen hammer. I mean, it's not going with a wrecking ball. It's going slow. But I feel the shift. There's joy in being a good man. It always doesn't look like joy when you're shelling out 250 grand and things ain't going your way. Callie asked me to walk her down the aisle when she gets married. How does that happen? You know what I'm thinking of? Well, I'll talk to her. I'll do it. But I want to pull the dad up with me. This guy's been an asshole for a lot of years. But it's his daughter. I would want to go up. That doesn't come from a guy like me. It comes from guys like you and God. So there's a shift. You got to go with that shift. You know, I told you guys about my wife. Unfortunately, you know, we read a book, The Five Languages of Love, years ago. One of our married couple friends said, you know, you should read this book. All right, let's read the book. And Cheryl likes little gifts and physical contact, touch. You know, she likes to be touched. I bristle with antagonism when I have to hold her hand. It's all the things I don't want to do. I don't want to go get a card. Do I have to get a card? Do I have to write in it? Come on. You know. She lights up. I write her love letters now. I've learned that. But that woman did one thing to me. So mine is I need the pat on the head. I need you to tell me I'm doing okay. I need that. And I know I need that. I hate that I need that. But I need it. And one day I was up against it, and I'm in a job that I don't like, and you know, I loved my job, but when politics got involved, it just got so in my head, I would get into it, and of course, you all identify, I get obsessed with it, right? It's not the ideal job. I'm lucky to be working. They fired me in 96, right? I mean, you know, but, and here I am the boss, but I'm just in that bad space. And my wife just stopped in the hallway one morning, random morning, nothing special going on. And she said, you know, she grabbed my face and she said, I just want to tell you, I'm so in love with you. And I appreciate every day you get up and go to work for this family. And we never have done without anything. The fact that our kids are in college and everybody's doing okay and Brett's sober, I am the happiest woman in the world. Fellas, I sat with 23 women and listened to what a piece of shit I was. And how I hurt them and their families. Does that one thing in the hallway make that all go away? No, but it's a start. And I've been in the trenches with this family for 18 years, not because I wanted to fucking run a bunch of times, but it's fleeting and soon lost, and I talk to my sponsors, you're not going anywhere, stop with the nonsense. You know, it's not that bad. They spent a little money, stop. You know, like, and I realize how ridiculous I am. Because it's my fear. So when we talk about iron on iron and steel on steel and men talking to men, where else can you talk about those fears? Those fears that cripple us in life. They cripple me. Anything that's good for me, I can run away from fear. Any fight I've ever had, it was from fear. I used to think I was a tough guy. No, you're afraid. If you're raising your voice, you're afraid. There's joy. And being a good man. There's joy in doing the right thing. Joy doesn't always feel good. For a guy like me, joy's uncomfortable. You know, one story about Cheryl and I. I had about 6 weeks of resentments on my 11 step when Joe was still alive. And it was about money, right? Money. The evil corroding fabric that's thrust through our marriage. We can't talk about it well. We don't do anything. Harold's got us on a business meeting once a month that we hold hands and pray before we do. That's how we got to talk about money in my house. And I'm writing resentments on Cheryl. And my sponsor, Joe, he had a knack. And he said, I get what you're saying, Tom. It's been 6 weeks now. I understand what's going on. He said, but I do need to ask some clarifying questions. And I said, what's up? And he said, so does Cheryl steal from you? And I said, no, where'd you get that out of the inventory? He said, no, I'm just asking. I just need to know. Is that something she does? She takes money out of the drawer or the credit card or whatever? And I said, no, not at all, Joe. I don't see where it's going yet. And he says, okay, so you willingly give her the money or the credit card, and then when she spends it for the intended purpose and maybe goes over the amount a little bit, you want to write these inventories and blame your money problems on her. Well, when you look at it that way. He said, well, Tom, can you tell me another way to look at it? I said, I preferred the way I was looking at it in inventory. But I know, how does this boomerang back on me? How does this do this? And he said, so would you consider, all right, here comes the dagger, all right, that you're not mature enough in your relationship or secure enough with your love for Cheryl that you can have a difficult conversation that every married couple has to have, and you're not willing to say no and get on a budget. And I said, yeah, that's what it is, Joe. I haven't had a resentment with Cheryl over money since, because I know it's my issue. I want to please my wife. I want things to be smooth. I don't want to have that difficult conversation. But we're having those conversations now. And she's grateful that we're having them. She knows everything about it. It's not just me taking care of things. She's in there. She's my partner. Makes her feel good. I didn't see that coming out of this. I just thought, oh man, uncomfortable conversations. I don't see that stuff by myself. I need a sponsor. I need somebody to tell me that stuff. I think if any one of you men talked to my wife and asked her what kind of husband is Tom, she said the best one that I could have asked for. I tell her all the time, she's my best friend and my best partner and the only wife I've ever had. We laugh about it. We've both been married twice before. I stand before you today, guys, just my heart is busted open. I am full of gratitude. And I'm joyful today. And I'm joyful because of the pains and the little trials that I've gone through to try to be a good man. But I still got some time left. I'm retired. I'm ready to work with others. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm going to keep loving my wife and my kids. And I just want to tell you one other thing. So I think I told you the story about, you know, my grandkid in church. He snuggles up with me. And they played Amazing Grace a little while ago and tears are coming down. And my little guy, 4 years old, you okay, Pop? I'm better than okay, Pop. I'm joyful. Who would have thought I could be happy and joyful in a Catholic church? That's like having Harold for a sponsor. How does that happen? You know, you put this bow hunting pastor from Missouri in the Ozarks with a guy from New York City. And it works. God, don't make mistakes here, man. It's just great. Keep doing what you're doing, fellas. Awesome stuff.
Man, how do you follow that up, man? Everything he said, how many of you guys have had that same conversation in a bar with the guy sitting next to you drinking?
Yeah,
I didn't think so. And I'm a crier too, but I have to ask you a question. Is it okay to cry during ED commercials? I'm sorry, I just, you know.
Yes.
Thank you, Bill. Rigorous honesty, as we say. Yeah, Tommy said we're going to do this topic, and I'm like, I guess like the last session, like, okay, I don't know what I'm going to talk about, you know, but we do know that the joy of living is the theme of the 12th step, and action is the key. All right, we can read all that literature. So who knows where I'm going to go right now for the next 30 minutes. I'm going to set my timer. I think you're sitting there. I was thinking about men that I sponsored through the years, and seeing men that came into my life just out of the clear blue, and seeing their lives get transformed and becoming the men that they have become. And there's a guy that I talk about once in a while, Blue Moon, especially around the amen, when I talk about, say, the amends. And he was from out here. He lived in Marin County. He belonged to a notorious motorcycle group that you guys can probably guess who that is. My wife sponsored his mother. And one day we were at my house, and his mom calls my wife, and she says, he's in serious trouble. And I'm going to fly him out here to New Jersey. Can Jimmy get some of the guys and grab him at the airport and do something? He's in big trouble. And so I don't know what I'm getting about. I'm about to walk into. I don't even know anything about this guy yet, you know? So he's tatted like most of us, and not me, but he's tatted from head to toe, you know? Larry Thomas used to have a great line, you know, when he would sit across from a guy that's tatted up in piercings, he goes, I would always just think there's an alcoholic behind all that stuff somewhere. And so we go to the airport, and this guy comes off. He's like built like, he's about the size of this podium. He's like, he has muscles on muscles. I mean, he's the strongest guy I've ever met in my life. Sorry, Mike Powers. You're second. So we pick him up, and, you know, and he's a mess. He's coming out of a crack house somewhere up in San Francisco area. We get him, and I go, you hungry? He goes, yeah, I'm hungry. And we go to the diner, and he's a workout freak, but he's a notorious gangster, basically, you know. And we get to the diner, and like, what do you want to eat? We think we'll just get potatoes in him and, you know, get some starches in him. And he's like, do they have avocado toast here? I said, oh, freaking typical California guy, avocado toast, you know. Yogurt with granola, you know. And he starts telling us the story of who he is, what he is, what he belongs to. And we pull him into the herd. You know, you're not filling out a resume on your life. We all know our lives, whatever it is, it's a mess. So, you know, we get him a job. We get him the typical AA job. He's landscaping, he's painting, he's, you know, building something. He's knocking down something, you know. We get him in the middle of the herd. We get him in a sober house with a bunch of guys that we know. And little by slowly, his life starts to get recreated. I start to take him through the steps. And he's doing better. And his mom is happy. And, you know, he's somewhat happy. You know, we get to his ninth step, and he starts to tell me about, you know, we go through the, you know, after his inventory, we go through, he has a lot of amends, a lot of amends, a lot of amends. And three of the big amends was that, one, it was he needed to quit this notorious motorcycle gang. Now, as you probably might know, maybe don't know, quitting a gang like that is not like, you know, giving up your membership at the Knights of Columbus. You know? And he knows he has to do that. But he's terrified. He also has to come back here to California because there's some warrants for his arrest. And the third thing he has to do is he has to go through a divorce with this woman. So we kind of prep him up. We pack his clothes and we send him back here to San Francisco. And he goes, and the first thing he does to make his amends is he goes to this clubhouse and tells them what he wants to do. And they said to him, well, before we let you go, you gotta have to do a few things. And he goes, I can't do that anymore. I can't do that anymore. And they said, well, okay, how about this? And I can't do that anymore. And they just basically said to him, well, then you know what's gonna happen right now, right? And he goes, I'm prepared for it. And three of these guys took him out in an alleyway and they almost beat him to death. You know, almost killed him. You know, he sent me a picture of him when he was finally in the infirmary in the prison. I'll go a little further into that. He was in the prison in the infirmary, and his head looked like an eggplant. It was purple from the kicks he got to the face and the head and everything like that. You know, he took a bad, bad beating. He's lucky he's alive, to be honest with you. And so the second thing was, you know, he got to go into prison. So I don't know, I forget the time frame that he had to go in. You know, well, first he goes through the divorce. He gets all that done, all the paperwork's in motion, and then he goes into the prison. I forget the time limit, but he had to get these warrants. He went to a lawyer, got a lawyer, blah, blah, blah. And he is pissed at me. He's pissed at you. He hates AA. He hates God. He hates everything about his life. Joy of being a good man, forget about that. That's never coming back, you know. Restless, irritable, and discontent is a mild headache. I mean, forget about it. And he's sitting in a prison yard in Northern California, and he's feeling sorry for himself with total regret and self-pity. And he's sitting there, and all of a sudden, a young man walks up to him in the prison yard and sits next to him. And the keys, and he gives me permission to tell his story. He goes, the kid came up to me, and he was pretty hyped up, like kind of like, what are you so happy about prison? And the kid comes and goes, hey, man, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm in prison to make my amends for some of the things I've done in the past. Do you know if there's an AA meeting here in this prison? And my sponsor, he looks at him and goes, no shit. And this kid just keeps on talking about it. And all of a sudden, my guy says to him, yeah, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous too. And the kid said to him, would you take me through the 12 steps while I'm here? And my man starts to take this kid through the 12 steps. Before he did that, in a prison yard in Northern California, two men get on their knees in the middle of the insanity of prison, and they held hands, and they said the third step prayer. And when he got off their knees, he took this man up to his ninth step when that guy got transferred off the pod, and he never saw him again. And then he knew why God had him in that prison. Because God was trying to help him become a man of joy, a man of contentment, a man of God. One of the things that broke his heart was that he walked out on an eight-year-old and a five-year-old, like good old me. And how am I going to reconstruct that? Right? So Jackson, his young son, you know, he came back to Jersey and he had all this guilt that he wasn't. I said, you need to go back home. You need to live in California again. And he came back here and he started a relationship with his son and he started a relationship with his daughter. He was that part-time, every other weekend, every Wednesday night dad, like some of us have been. And life started to get better. And he got a job. He was in the construction field. And then his son Jackson, you know, about 15, 16 years old, smoked a little weed, doing little things, you know, the route, starting to get in a lot of trouble. And he would call me, what do I do? And I would call some guys that I know in treatment business up here in Northern California. They would take the kid under the wing, blah, blah, blah. And he's just in and out, in and out, in and out. So I had the opportunity to speak at I don't know, you guys might correct me, the Ventura County Conference, I think it's called, last year. And I'm the Sunday morning speaker, and it's a big crowd there. And everyone stays because there's a countdown, there's raffles, all that kind of stuff. And Shay says, I'm coming, but I'm bringing Jackson. I said, great. I have no idea where Jackson is in his life. And so, you know, I see Jackson. I'm like, holy shit, you know, last time I seen him, he was this big. Now he's like this big. I'm like, oh, my God, these kids are getting so big. And he's there. And, you know, I'm at the podium on Sunday night. And I look down into the crowd. I'm about to tell my story. But God's pushing me and moving me to talk about this kid and how your life could be reconstructed in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when you don't have your kids in your life. And his son is sitting right next to him. And I'm telling his story. And this kid, or this guy I sponsor, who's like a brick wall, is crying his eyes out in front, and I can see it. And now I start crying up here. And then I tell the story, you know, we tell my story, and I get off the podium, and now they're doing a countdown. Right? The oldest guy, some guy with about 50-something years, is up here, and blah, blah, blah. They start the down count, down to the lowest man. They go, anyone here with one day? And Jackson stands up. So they bring the old timer and Jackson up. And Jackson turns to his father, and I can't even tell you, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. The joy of being a good man? Huh. I don't even know how to explain that title. I witnessed it. The Father and the Son reunited, like he just talked about. The opportunities we're getting here to heal. And all we have to really do is be of service to others. Isn't that what this is about? The joy of being a good man is rooted in service. How we show up for each other in here, how we show up for each other at our families, how we show up for each other in life. I didn't know that. I had no idea about that. I came here, as you heard, and it's just like everyone in this room. I came here broken. I don't know how to be a man. I don't know how to be a human. I'm a savage. And we see lives get reconstructed in here day in and day out. And we get to witness that. I didn't know what that this was about. I just don't want to drink. That's what I thought this was about. I had no idea about the benefits, the families being healed, we piss and moan about money. Meanwhile, while I'm drinking, I'm just throwing money away. Like, all of a sudden, I'm concerned about money. we get our heads so far in the clouds, we don't even know what our purpose is here sometimes. So it's just been, and I think it's always the amends stories that get me. Because when I see people make these amends and they get through the things they get through, there's no way I'm going to get through this. And then all of a sudden we get a little pat in the ass by the old timers. Our sponsor walks us through the process. We've got friends that support us in these decisions. And all of a sudden, we heal. We heal. One of the biggest things I ever thought in my life that I would never get through, I got indicted on 2 counts of grand theft when I was sober a year. And see, in New Jersey, when you get a letter with the state seal, they're not asking your opinion about anything in the state. You're in trouble. But see, I'm afraid, I'm terrified. And I'm also not going to talk about this because I'm ashamed. Shame plays a great part in my life. And most alcoholics have shame-based identities. And I'm not going to talk about it because I think you're going to judge me if you know I'm a thief. Back in the 70s, I ripped off unemployment for $27,881.76, thinking I could outfox a computer. Delusional thinking, of course, but the mind of the drinker and the alcoholic and the addict, I think I can pull this one off, right? And I get indicted. I don't talk about it. And as you've heard my story, I haven't written the steps. I might have read the steps off the wall, but I never applied the steps to my life. So I'm 5 years sober with this secret, walking around AA with a big smile on my face, terrified because every time I look over my shoulder, I think I'm going to get tackled by a cop, by an FBI agent, by an IRS agent. I don't know. All fear, 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 fear. So at 5 years, when I write my first inventory, because I was willing and because I was terrified that I think I'm going to drink again, I put this on this inventory and I share it with this man. And he taught me what to do. And the first thing I had to do was go back to that ex-wife of mine and tell her that I might be going back to jail on this one. But there's no way in hell that I'm ever going to get through this, I know I'm not going to stay sober with a secret. I know that's one thing that was always implanted in my head and I knew it. I am not staying sober with secrets. So I got to deal with this. And I'll never forget, I went to the court that day, and I seem to be in court a lot when I'm sober. I don't know why, but, some of you guys gave me good suggestions. Get a bunch of your home group members, write nice letters about you and shit like that. And, I had a guy at the end of the line, Jimmy makes good coffee on Tuesday. Like, what are you talking about? Ridiculous stuff. But I sat there and the judge showed up and he goes, after listening to these men and after hearing about what you've done in your life in the last bunch of years, it would be really a shame to put you in jail again. It seems like you're an asset to your AA community and your fellowship in trying to help men. I said, Your Honor, I'm doing the best I can. That's God's honest truth. I'm just doing the best I can. And I guess he saw fit, or maybe God was working through him. He goes, I'm not going to put you in jail. I will put you on probation for the next 5 years of your life. And you are going to pay that $27,000 and change back. But we have a thing in New Jersey called interest. And I'm tacking interest on that money. And I think the final bill was about $34,000. And you're going to pay it back. Or you will go to jail. Well, let me tell you what happened. I became a better worker. I became a more honest guy. And I worked my ass off. And I paid that $34,000 back in 2 years. What does that have to do with the joy of being a good man? These are the things I had to walk to get to that place of being the joy of a good man. Is by cleaning up that past and looking at these things. And I didn't want to look at these things. I want to run from these things. That's my nature. I'm a runner. I don't want to be honest. I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to talk to these guys. I don't want to pray. I don't want to meditate. I don't want to do any of that stuff. I don't want to be of service. And why I don't want to be is because I'm afraid. A tough guy like me is afraid. And I don't see how fear dominates my life all the time and really robs me of the opportunity of being a good man. Because my mind tells me differently. That's why I need a sponsor. That's why I got to talk about the things he talked about. Because my vision screwed up. You know, this new pair of glasses. You know, I needed to like switch glasses with one of you guys. I needed to see life and this whole thing from a different angle. So the sober life has really just, you know, cleared the way for integrity to start coming in my house. To be a better man. You know, I came this week, and I got to be honest with you. I'm not feeling like on top of my game. If that even means anything. I feel like I'm in AA right now. I don't. Maybe it's just a little period of just. It's not nothing big, you know. I heard Sheldon Fetty speak on a Zoom call about 3 weeks ago, and I think he put it perfectly. He said for the last 2 years, he's lost the face of God. I haven't lost faith, but, you know, kind of like going through the motions a little bit. Not big. Still doing everything I need to do. I pray every day. I meditate every day. I write inventory every day. Help others the best I can. But it's just I'm just at that place right now. I think a lot of us hit that place sometimes. It's just a little, I don't know. I don't even know the right word I'm trying to say. It's just a little blasé, you know? Maybe that means I need to write another inventory. Maybe I need to move to California. I don't know what that means. I mean, and then become a member of the HBMS group.
Yeah.
That sounds like a notorious biker gang. As well, they are. Hornet. But I know one thing that has always worked for me is that being of service has always got me out of the doldrums of life and sobriety, you know? And who knew that in order to get out of the darkness of my life, I had to serve others. And everything about being a man of joy is about being of service. I didn't know that. And sometimes I forget that. You know, like Tommy, you know, I got two kids, right? My kids are good kids. Very lucky. When my son was in college, he was down in Maryland. Alcoholism and college look very alike.
Yes.
And I thought he was going to be one of us for a period of time there. But you know what? He's a smart kid, and anything could happen. We know that. But he got interested in a career, and he got hired he became an intern. He worked 11 years for that company in New Jersey as a project manager for a financial company. He made great money, like I told you. And then he just got a new job. He just got hired as a company in London that's trying to build a base here in the United States. And he's doing real well. He bought a house. Just got married about a month ago. Beautiful little boy that I watched two times. You know what it's like to be 67 years old and watch a one-year-old for 9 hours? It's a young man's sport. And this kid's starting to walk. Well, he is walking. He's running around. And I'm like, it's only a matter of time before I bring him back to that house with the Band-Aid over his head or blood gushing out, because, you know, he's going to hit something, that's for sure. And as much as I complain or goof around and say stuff like that, it is the joy of my life to watch a one-year-old change his shitty diaper and play with him and try to whatever we're doing all day long. And my road dog, he's my new road dog now. And I had the same thing with my three-year-old granddaughter. But my daughter she was a special ed teacher. She taught for 10 years special ed kindergarten, and that's a gift. To be able to be with 20 special ed kids in kindergarten and help them. And then she became a board certified behavioral analyst, where she'd help really troubled kids. And when she got a degree in that, I said, listen, I got about 15 sponsees. You could practice. They're all screwed up. You could help them. But she's been lucky enough to retire for a time being because her husband has a pretty good construction company. You know, and I watched her daughter, my granddaughter, 3 years old now. And so I don't know where I'm going with all this stuff. All I know is, you know, this joy of living, you know, that, you know, that self-respect, sounds like a therapy term, but self-respect has definitely replaced the shame that I walked around with. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of dignity I have learned, I have gotten in here. You know, there's been things that I never thought I'd get through, and, you know, there's trust in my life. My kids trust me. That was my big question. How do you make amends to an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old and walk out of their life? How do you make amends to that? You taught me how to make amends to that. Like I said, Larry Thomas had, that was the greatest line he ever said. What he said that day to me was, Jimmy, you might not be somebody's husband, but you'll always be someone's father. I got it. I heard that. Suit up, show up, no matter what. And thank God I have. And thank God I listened to that guy. You know, so this, it's not an overnight matter. We say that all the time. This whole deal is not an overnight matter. The joy of living is our theme of all, you know, the 12th step, obvious, but the joy of living is what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. You know, we're not supposed to be in here crying about the sad state of the nation. We should be practicing these principles in all our affairs and doing the best we can. And, you know, again, we do that through sponsorship. We do that through, you know, one of the things I love about Bob, you know, I've had 5 sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous. First one was the guy that 12-stepped me, Richie Schnorr, first 5 years. Wasn't a big book guy. Eventually he did become a big book guy. You know, he was just a guy that was, you know, in the trenches, man, helping drunks, 12-step calls like I told you about. Second guy was that guy, Bill Grace, who died 16 years, drank after 16 years. Taught me the most important thing about, took me through this book. First guy that took me through the steps. Third guy was this guy named Audie Burns. Audie Burns just died last year with 58 years of sobriety. And when I moved from the city down to the shore, you know, I told you about my old man. He was a butcher. That whole story, I'm not going to go into that, but, you know, I'm looking for a sponsor. I would hear this guy Audie, man. I'm like, man, that guy sounds good, man. I think I like what he has, you know? And so I got the courage enough. I mean, not really courage, but I said, I'm going to go ask this guy to sponsor me. And I had no idea about what he did in a professional career, but I went up to him and I said, hey, Audie, I'm looking for a sponsor. Would you be willing to take me on as a sponsor? He goes, Jimmy, I would love to be your sponsor. I said, by the way, what do you do for a living? He goes, I'm a butcher. Thank you, God. Now I get it. Now I get it. But he's the guy I lied to. He's the guy that I gave 20% to. He's the guy that I really hurt with my behavior at the 10-year mark when I went out on that woman. Right? But we mended fences. We mended fences. And I got a picture in my room. It was at the 2000 Minnesota Convention, International Convention. And boy, that man taught me so much about Alcoholics Anonymous. Taught me about recovery, taught me about the joy of being a good man. He was never married. He was the head of the employee assistance program for all the grocery workers in the tri-state area, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. 23,000 men, 23,000 members under him that he would help. He went through the Rutgers School of Alcoholism. That was a big time back then, and the Yale School of Alcoholism, you know, for these guys that were learning. He helped a lot of men. And then Peter Marinelli became my sponsor for the next 17 years. And we're the closest brothers, me and him. And I needed a new voice in my head. I know it, because it just got routine with him. We just wasn't doing the, not that it, like, I think Tommy said, it wasn't like, you know, sponsor. It was no, we were very close. We were like this. We were road dogs too. But I needed a new voice in my head. And I was thinking about Bob, and, you know, I called 3 people in the United States, and I didn't tell who I was thinking about. And the minute I said, I'm looking for, why don't you call Bob Bezance? Why don't you call Bob Bezance? And I called Bob and he goes, can you get to Minnesota? I said, when do you want me there? And I went up to Minnesota and we sat. He's been my sponsor for a little. And Bob, like I said, you know, Bob's, you know, I think of all the other sponsors, they'll give you an hour and a half on the phone. Bob, good luck.
Yeah.
And he doesn't care where you are. 8 minutes? Woo, man, that was a long talk. But if Bob, if you have something going on with your life, Bob will sit with you all day and talk about it and guide you through it, whatever, from his experience. Bob sponsors a guy by the name of Paul M., the Irishman. Some of you guys know him. And it's funny because Paul came up to me one day. He goes, can I ask you a question? I said, what's that? He goes, when you call Bob, and I knew immediately where he was going, I said, yeah, when Bob and me talk, it's about an hour and a half every day. And Paul just looked at me and said, I'm just pulling your leg. We can about 8 minutes, we're good to go, you know. But Bob has, these guys, a lot of these guys, you guys know him, you know, he was supposed to be here this weekend, but he got sick, you know, just been invaluable. And I want what he has, 58 years down the road, you know, he's a beacon to me, you know, and just an important person in my life. But, you know, Bob says it all the time. It's just a conversation we're having here, guys. Just a conversation, pitchers and catchers. Me and Tommy, maybe the pitchers or however you want to look at that, and you're the catchers this weekend. Next year, it'll be two of you other guys up here, and two other guys, and two other guys. But that pitcher and catching goes on in that dining room, or on the ride home, where one guy's talking, one drunk talking to another, sharing experience, strength, and hope. You know, the joy of being a good man. You know, I've been given this gift, this precious gift, you know. You know, Bill writes one of the greatest things, you know, we've had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. Well, what is a spiritual experience? Now, if you read the 12 and 12, it says, when a man, woman, or has a spiritual awakening experience, the most important thing, meaning is that he has now become able to do, feel, and believe, which he cannot do before on his own unaided strength and resources alone. He has been granted a gift, which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. He has been set on a path which tells him he's really going somewhere, that life is not a dead end and not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, he has been transformed because he has laid hold of a source of strength which in one way or another he had until now denied himself. He finds himself in the possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, and love of which he had thought himself quite incapable. What he has received is a free gift. What are you doing with your gift? You want to be a good man? You want to experience the joy of being a good man? Then here's the question. What are you doing with your gift? Are you hoarding it? Or are you giving it away for fun and for free? The joy of being a good man, the only way I could think of this is, you know, being of service. And by being of service, God is taking care of me and my family. Of all the trials and tribulations that happen, with all the things I've been through, at the end of the day, I stand here a free man. Free as a bird. There's nothing in my life right now that's going on that I need to talk to him about or any of these guys about. It's been a gift. It's been unbelievable. Done a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. You heard me talk about service and all that other stuff. You know, that was a great opportunity, but it's only, you know, thank God for the spirit of rotation. You do it and you go. Right? When I was the delegate at in my state and for Area 44, that's my area, Northern New Jersey, I was the closest living delegate to the General Service Conference when I had to drive into Brooklyn, New York to do that my second year. First year was virtual, the second year was in person. And so everyone else had to fly into LaGuardia or Kennedy, wherever they were coming from, but I was only 60 miles away from Brooklyn, so I got in my truck and I drove up to Brooklyn. And on the way up to Brooklyn, I had to go through my hometown because that's New York's on one side of the Holland Tunnel, New Jersey's on the other side of the Holland Tunnel, and the city I grew up is on that side of the tunnel. And before I went through the Holland Tunnel, I had a little time to kill. I said, let me go drive through my old neighborhood. It's been years, you know, let me go see what it looks like. I know they built it up and all this, you know, it's like all high rises and office buildings. A lot of New York City has now come to New Jersey. They got tax abatements, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's a lot going on that I haven't seen in a long time. So I drove my truck into the first thing I did is I drove into the neighborhood that I grew up in. You ever go back to the place you grew up in and you say to yourself, how did it shrink? Like it seemed like my neighborhood was like a universe. And when I got back to it, it was like, it's so small. It's so small. And I drove up Warner Avenue. That's the street I grew up on. And I pulled up to the house that I was raised in. A two-family house. With my mom, my dad, five of us on the first floor, my aunt, my uncle, six on the second floor. One bathroom, one toilet bowl, I mean, one phone, you know. And I looked at the house and I'm like, a lot went on in that house. There was a lot of violence in that home. But here I am outside that house now, a free man. I drove to Wally's. Wally's was the first bar I ever got served in at 15 years old. My chin hit the bar, I was able to get in that bar. And I thought about that old man bar, shot and beer joints, 25-cent tap beer, 50-cent shots, Fleischmann's. You Fleischmann's drinkers, if you even know what that is. But then I drove the streets. The streets that I would almost walk around for 2 years doing that aimless walk of homelessness. Sleeping in cars, sleeping in bug-infested mattresses, sleeping in hallways, sleeping in wherever, putting my head down wherever I could put. And I started to cry. Because I was about to go to Brooklyn, New York as a delegate for my area representing Northern New Jersey Alcoholics Anonymous. And trying to play a small part in a big wheel, just a spoke. Gratitude, pouring out of me. The life I've been given because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Owe it to you, owe it to God, obviously. Owe it to these 12 steps. The joy I'm living right now, that is a 67-year-old man, the joy of life. When we say restless, irritable, and discontent, Don Landis said it once, and I never heard it this way. He said, discontent sounds like we're not satisfied. Discontent has another meaning. And what that means is we don't know how to experience joy. And there was a time in my life you could put a baby in my hands and I wouldn't even be happy to have a baby in my hands. But you've put this thing in my hands called sobriety, recovery. And boy, oh boy, I can cry every day with the gift I've been given. Men, this has been an unbelievable weekend for me. So thankful to be here. Thank you, Bill, for the invitation. I hope you brought an adequate presentation of two knuckleheads from the East Coast. And that's all I have. Thank you so much.